Good afternoon. So hopefully you're here for 4414, section one. So first, just some logistics. So lectures are, as you can see, via Zoom. There will be recordings afterwards. I'm not going to require attendance. I'm not going to check attendance. There will be poll questions during lecture. You know, which won't be recorded, not graded, or, and I won't even like record the results of them besides just discussing them during the lecture. If you aren't watching live, I generally recommend doing things like writing down questions that you could ask later. You know, try to avoid making it a passive thing and try to also actually watch the lectures and not skip over them, etc. So some other logistics, there's a course webpage that's linked off Colab, so which has sort of all the sort of policies, has the schedule, has assignment write-ups. It's where lecture recordings will be linked. So most of the information is there that you'll need later in the semester. So as for getting help in this class, we're going to have office hours via Discord, which many of you would be familiar with from other classes. There's instructions on the website. There's a Discord invite link on Colab because I don't like to put it on a publicly accessible website. We're using a Q website, which you sign up for online. The first few slots in the queue are going to be first come, first served, and the later slots are going to be ordered by the last time you were helped. The intention of this is to make it so there's minimal benefit to always being on the queue, and related to that, we can reset those first few numbered slots to be reordered by the last time you were helped in between office hours to make it so if you, say, sign up for the 9 a.m. office hours at 10 p.m. the previous day, you don't get an advantage over someone who does it at 8:50 a.m. because we really don't want to encourage that. It's not very nice to look at the office hour queue and have people who aren't actually there. We don't want to create incentives to try to, you know, sign up the night before or anything like that. Our hope, of course, is that we have enough TA capacity that the length of the queue isn't an issue. We'll see how successful I am at that. So there's a calendar for office hours, and my office hours are on there. I may be splitting my time with this course and the other course I'm teaching, 4630, by just having one office hour time and watching both queues. If that happens, it may look like I'm not helping someone, but I'm really helping someone in the other class. If this doesn't work, I might do separate office hour times for each course. We'll see. I'll see how it goes. So that's office hours. I guess. Shin. The other way of getting help is Piazza, which is linked off the Colab. So as far as other things in this class, so most of the grade and probably the biggest hardest classes, there are going to be programming assignments, homeworks, which are all individual. The first ones due next week. They're mostly in C or C++. There's going to be one that will probably be in Python. The assignments are either 1 or 2 weeks long. If they are 2 weeks long, they are worth more points. And if they're 2 weeks long, there will be a checkpoint submission in the middle of the assignment. Because I have found that if I don't do that, a lot of people don't seem to grasp that the reason we're giving 2 weeks is because the assignment will take you longer. The assignments are mostly due on Fridays, but there's some exceptions because of how I'm trying to work around the interesting break day schedule this semester. So consult the calendar for that. So several of the assignments are going to use a teaching operating system known as XV6, which is based on Unix version 6. So basically, some people at MIT at some point made a sort of rewrite of this, because they were originally using the original Unix version 6 in their course. The original Unix version 6 is written for some hardware, which is pretty hard to obtain these days, so they rewrote it for 32-bit x86. That's the version we're going to use. They currently have a version that uses RISC-V. I'm going to stick with the 32-bit x86 version, partly so I can reuse stuff I did in previous semesters, and partly because you kind of know x86 assembly, which will make things easier. So this OS here that we're going to be working with in assignments, it's sort of very minimal, but it's enough that it should boot on real 32-bit x86 hardware. We're not actually going to do that. We're going to use an emulator because the logistics are a lot simpler. It theoretically supports multi-core. We're going to have assignments where we talk about using multiple cores, but we're not going to have XV6 run in that mode just to keep things a little simpler. Even though our emulator supports emulating a multi-core system. So we're going to have, besides the homeworks, some quizzes. They're going to be online, of course, untimed, probably should remove, but, and starting this week, I will show you how it works on Thursday, if you haven't seen it before, from 3330, which I've taught this way, with this same quiz system. They're open books, open notes, open internet, but individual. And they will generally be about the week's lecture material, the prior week's wet lecture material, to make sure you're keeping up, and also because we want a way of assessing things that don't come up in assignments. I also intend to have a final exam of some sort. My current plan is that it would be a take-home thing where we give you 24 hours that overlap our officially scheduled final time, which I will interpret as the slot for the 12:30 p.m. Tuesday-Thursday section, not a combined final time for 44:14, since the two sections this semester are doing their own thing. It's probably going to be kind of like the quizzes. There might be some longer answers. This is subject to change. It might make sense for me to like have a programming exercise or two that would be submitted differently, included with this, like a short programming exercise. So that's assignments. The course has a late policy. It's on the website. You can read the website to figure out what it is. Please read it carefully. It's slightly different for checkpoint submissions versus not. Okay, so questions about logistics of office hours, homeworks, exams, quizzes. There's a question about the wait list. I will get to that in a bit. So, in terms of other requirements, question. Do quizzes have a time limit? No, there is no time limit. It's not even 24-hour period for the quizzes. The quizzes are no time limit. For the exam, probably for the final exam, I'll probably do 24 hours. Which will be when it's released, when it's not. The intention for both of these is that there's not time, that there shouldn't be actual time pressure. And the question is, do we not have a midterm? There is no midterm. I don't think it makes sense to do online quizzes and try to make a midterm work in this format. I don't think they'll be sufficiently different. Um, When will the slides be updated on the schedule? After... I will check after this lecture. The link should have worked. Probably something is not working with my scripts that update the website. Okay, so pause. Another thing is textbooks. There's no required textbook. My recommended textbook is Anderson and Dahlin, Operating Systems Principles in Practice, which, you know, is probably, I think, the most useful. Some of the material we have will follow that a bit. Also quite useful, and there's some topics where Anderson and Dahlin doesn't cover, is Arpeggio de Sue's Operating Systems 3 Easy Pieces, which is available as a PDF or set of PDFs from the authors quite legitimately. I think this is a very good book. I think its coverage of some of the concurrency stuff, which is probably, some of the trickier stuff in this class, is a little terse compared to Anderson Dahlin, which is why Anderson Dahlin's my recommended textbook, but you can get Arpeggio de Sue as free PDFs, so it's quite a reasonable resource. Question on, things about cheating. So we have these programming assignments. They are individual programming assignments. Please do not use code from prior semesters, except perhaps your own, and like if you took 4414 in the prior semester and dropped. Don't share code. Don't share pseudocode. Don't share detailed descriptions of your code. You're welcome to talk about sort of general strategy stuff, but not something which kind of substitutes for code. And generally do not use code from the internet. But this is acceptable if you're solving things that aren't the point of the assignment. So as an example, if we have an assignment like, say, our shell assignment that's coming up where it might be useful to split a string into an array, using some code you found online to do that is fine because that's not the point of the assignment. Like, it's clearly not the big thing we're trying to get you to do. But if you do this, you need to credit where it's used. I should not look at your submission and wonder, that looks like a different style. Where did that come from? If you're using code for this reason, it should be clear in what you submit that that happened. With the exception that if we supply code in the assignment write-up, which we occasionally do, we don't care if you credit that because we know where it came from. And if you're unsure if something works, ask. And sort of cases where, which obviously wouldn't fit in this is like for the shell assignment, if you find a shell online, that is not an acceptable resource. And for more corner case things, you can ask us. So homeworks are individual, quizzes are also individual, but they're open book, open notes, open internet, so don't share answers, don't IM people, regardless of whether or not they're in the class for answers, and don't ask on Stack Overflow or similar sites for answers. If someone's asked a similar related question on Stack Overflow, that obviously, I'm not going to stop you from looking at that, but don't look for the actual question as is, but you can look for related material, of course. Okay, that's on cheating. On the wait list, if you want an exception to the wait list, you need to explain to me why you cannot register for Professor Lin's section. I think I have about the TA capacity for 150 students. I think we're at 148 when I last checked. But I have one person probably to let in. So it's pretty tight, right? Pretty tight. And I want to be careful about that. And I want to make sure I prioritize people who can't make the other section and or are actually, you know, need this course now to graduate on time. And sort of general, getting help, there's a piazza, there's office hours, so there's a calendar for office hours. Probably a lot bunch aren't posted because RTAs are still figuring out their schedule. You can also email me, putting 4414 in the subject line, may be helpful if you do that, so I know how to categorize your email. And any logistics questions? Question is, do I have an estimate on how many people will drop before the February 16th? I have no idea. And, you know, normally to get an estimate, I like look at what happened last time, and it's not comparable for a whole bunch of reasons. Question is, where do you send this? You either email me or private post on Piazza. And I should note that the sort of justification I'm looking for is things like I'm taking another class at that time. Other questions? Okay, so this course is about operating systems, and sort of our first order of business is, well, what is an operating system? And sort of one view of history is that there used to be a job called a computer operator. And here are some computer operators operating a Honeywell 800. And the operators need to do things like deal with actually putting the tapes and other input devices into the computers and switching things on and off and sort of running programs and starting them. And that's sort of, you know, that sort of administrative task of loading program, loading things on the computer, getting it running. You know, that's what the software that's an operating system does that, you know, previously maybe wasn't really automated. That previously maybe you actually had someone physically load a program by taking the program and putting it in the right part of the machine and pressing the toggle switches to make that be used. But, you know, we have that high-level idea, but the specifics are actually very fuzzy. There's a whole bunch of different exact definitions for what an operating system is. And if you point at, like, specific examples of things that might be an operating system, you'll get different answers from, you know, people who should know what they're talking about. So they'll say things, you know, like, let's say, for example, code to allow moving windows. Like if I can click on a Windows title bar and move it around, is that part of the OS? Well, if you ask people, you'll get different answers. Some people will say yes, some people will say no, some people will say, well, it depends where that code's running. And similarly, you might say, well, is code that supports printers, is that part of the OS, or is that just a program that runs on an OS? You know, you'll get different answers for that. So we're not going to give a precise definition of OS. I don't have a grand correct definition because there isn't one. There's, you know, people are going to disagree about things like this. We're going to give sort of the general principles of things an OS does and talk about some things which are, you know, almost always considered part of an OS, which is going to be the focus of a lot of this class, are things that are almost always considered definitely part of an OS. And our two textbooks have sort of definite high-level definitions of what an operating system is. So Anderson Dahlin says it's software that manages a computer's resources. And Arpeshi Dasu has this sort of other perspective that an OS provides a virtual machine. And when they say virtual machine, they don't mean like VirtualBox or VMware or these other pieces of software you may have seen which run another OS. They mean this idea of an interface that can run programs that's more convenient than sort of the real hardware. We'll talk about what that, you know, specifically encompasses later. So these are two different focuses, but they're getting at the same thing. So Anderson Dahlin, we'll start there. They say it manages a computer's resources. So what are the resources? And we'll see, you know, resources are things like the CPU and memory, storage, devices. So these are sort of traditionally what we consider resources, but maybe there's a longer list. Anderson Dahlin's kind of being deliberately ambiguous about what counts as a resource. Now, Anderson Dahlin goes into some more detail of having this sort of different roles that an OS takes, because managing is, it's a lot of things. And they sort of have these three different ideas. So one is that OSs in managing a resource kind of act as a referee, that there's multiple things that want to use those resources, and the OSs are responsible for making that work. So this means that they need to manage resource sharing, that for if I have two programs running on one core, we have to share that core. If I have two programs running and there's one piece of RAM, they have to share that RAM. If I have two programs running using one disk, they have to share that disk. OSs make that resource sharing work. We also have protection, which is, you know, one program doesn't interfere with another. And or, you know, one program can't interfere with the OS. And isolation, which is programs, you know, are separated from each other somehow, that they separated from each other except when they don't want to be. So that, you know, if I'm running my web browser or my text editor, I'm not going to expect things I do in my text editor to cause my web browser to change unless, like, there's some intentionality behind that. So that's one thing. And the other is getting more to what Arpeshi Dasu focuses on, these two attributes that are part of managing resources, is that what Arnison Dahlin calls the illusionist idea of having these clean, easy abstractions, that OSs are going to provide interfaces to access things like processors and memory and disk that are cleaner in some way, or easier, or better, at least different than the actual underlying hardware, which is kind of going to be uglier in some way. And OSs also end up providing what Anderson Dahlin calls glue, sort of common services, like so windowing systems, that mean things that display windows on a screen, that's what that means. Storage management, authorization and meaning letting you log in, knowing who's logged in, networking, communicating with other machines, and so on. So whatever these views we have, we typically picture the OS is kind of something which sits between applications and the hardware. That it's this is an abstraction layer that's, you know, that conceptually, at least, we'll learn that, you know, it's not, maybe not really true, but conceptually, the application doesn't do anything to the hardware without going through the operating system. In reality, the details might be a little more complicated than that, but conceptually, the OS decides what interface the application sees. And that's this virtual machine concept, that we can think of it as, well, we have this application and it runs on a machine and it has some interface by which it communicates with that machine. And we're going to call that interface a virtual machine interface. And the OS gets to decide what that interface is. And the OS, well, it has to talk to the actual machine, the physical hardware. And there's going to be a physical machine interface that the OS needs to use to do that. So this is sort of a general concept of a virtual machine. You might say, but I heard of virtual machines as things which run, you know, other OSs, that where we're doing, we have the hardware, we have OS 1, we have the virtual machine software, and we have OS 2. And we can kind of consider this as sort of a case of, we have hardware, the virtual machine monitor / OS 1 and OS 2 as well. What these are is, this is still a virtual machine, like this general idea, but the virtual machines you're familiar with are what we might call system virtual machines, where the design of this virtual machine interface is that it imitates a physical interface. I say a physical interface because usually it's easier to not actually imitate the interface of the underlying hardware, but you choose some hardware that real OSs, quote unquote, are designed to use. And this is great if you want to take a copy of Windows that was written to run on real hardware, but that's typically not the sort of applications we're running. So for those, we have an interface where when the operating system chooses this virtual machine interface, they don't choose to imitate a physical interface like we would do to get this scenario. We choose to imitate something that's convenient. And in this case, we have what is sometimes called a process virtual machine. And the name comes because sort of the convenient interface is this abstraction called a process. That's what we're going to provide. And it's going to have things which, you know, wouldn't make sense to implement in physical hardware, but are way more convenient for programming applications. We'll go through some specific examples of those abstractions, many of which you're pretty familiar with, in a bit. So questions on sort of our definition of OS and this idea of this virtual machine interface. So, I said our process virtual machine has these things chosen for convenient. So, some examples, if we think of real hardware, in real hardware we have processors that can run instructions and have registers. The sort of traditional process virtual machine, which is most of what we'll be talking about this semester, the operating system provides an interface that has instead what we'll call threads, which, you know, kind of look like processors, but they have some attributes that real hardware processors wouldn't have. One big example is that usually you can create as many threads as you like. You obviously, when you're talking to real hardware, you can't say, hey hardware, right now I want you to have 10 processors, but some other time I want you to have 3. That's not a thing that would work in real hardware, but that's an interface we can provide to applications, And it's sure very convenient for applications to be able to do this. And it's something that the operating system will provide because it's just way more convenient than trying to expose something that looks more like real processors. Another example is memory management. So the real hardware is going to provide something like page tables to manage the memory. That's not typically a useful interface for processes, that when you're writing a program, you want to say, allocate me some space and tell me where it is. You don't want to actually have to figure out, you know, what entry in a page table to change and have that work. And in particular, you know what your memory needs to look like. You don't want to have to worry about what's going on in the underlying system. So we have these sort of higher level memory allocation functionality that abstracts, the real hardware interface of page tables. Another classic example is devices. So if we're writing to the screen, if we're writing to disk, we typically are used to this interface of files. Files, I'm using this term very generically. So these are things which you open, read, write, and close. So when I talk about files in this class, we're going to include files that aren't what POSIX and calls quote unquote regular files, which is files that store data persistently, e.g. on a disk. As well as sort of files that represent devices that represent, say, a terminal, a screen, a device hooked up to the machine, etc. So files are going to be things that represent all these things, and you've used files before. Like if you want to read from the keyboard, you have a file you read from. That's not one of these regular files that's stored persistently on disk like you would save in a word processor, but it's the same interface. And in particular, regardless of what kind of file you're dealing with, you have this read-write interface that is convenient to use where you don't have to worry about how do the hard drives actually work? How does the keyboard actually communicate with the machine? These details are all abstracted away and we have this much more convenient interface. This is sort of what we expect when we're writing applications. And this is provided by our operating system because it has to sort of bridge this gap between this file interface and the actual way devices communicate with hardware, which we'll talk about a bit later in the semester. So I believe I've mentioned this, you may remember this from 3030. So I talked about the process virtual machine providing processes. You might say, well, process wasn't on the list here. So a process for this class is one or more threads. So which remember was sort of approximately like a virtual CPU and address spaces, which is going to be our abstraction of, memory. So that memory allocation service, abstracted away. And this is kind of the illusion of a dedicated machine, that we have everything we need to run code. We have a processor, a fake processor, and we have memory. And also, we're going to have, as we'll learn, files. And that's our devices. So it's all these things put together makes a process. And that's sort of what we think of when we think of a running program is one of these processes. And that's the abstraction our operating system creates. So if we look at things this way, what our operating system does is that we have these applications, which have these threads, address spaces, process files, and so on. And as far as the application is concerned, this is the machine they're running on. And the operating system's goal is to translate the machine the applications think they're running on, which has all these really fancy features we can't actually implement directly in hardware into the hardware interface. So, from the application's point of view, you know, this is the machine that they're running on is the operating system. When we write an application, we are writing it for an operating system, not for a particular piece of hardware. So this is advantageous both because, you know, these interfaces are more useful, like we have files instead of the, you know, sector numbers on a disk, for example, but also because it's kind of future-proof that when I write my application code, you know, that ran on a system with a spinning hard drive and we switched over to SSDs, didn't make any difference to me. You know, or if we're running on a machine where actually the files are stored on a remote server, didn't change my application because I wrote it for this operating system interface, not for a hardware interface. So the operating system's goal is to translate this nice interface to the hardware one. And, you know, if the hardware changes, we're going to change this translation. The applications don't need to change. We want to provide more services to the application. We'll change this translation to add those services. And when I started out, you know, mentioning our definitions of OSs, one of the things we got to was, well, these abstractions, you know, let us share resources. Let's sort of go through this work. So our application here, we have a process where, which remember has memory and one or more threads. The threads have registers. So an application is running, you know, how is the operating system going to implement this abstraction? Well, the application thinks it has a process which has some, you know, memory that it has dedicated to itself and a virtual CPU. When it's running, well, that virtual CPU is going to be implemented by using the real CPU, and the memory is going to be implemented by allocating a subset of the actual physical memory. And the big reason we have these abstractions, besides sort of making it the interface more convenient, is to run multiple applications at once. So in this case, let's say we have a second application. It has its own process. Its memory is implemented again with a different subset of the physical memory. But it also has sort of registers because it has a thread that's, you know, looks like a virtual CPU. But if our hardware only has one real processor, that means we're going to implement this by, well, at some point in time, keeping the register stored somewhere else because we can't store it on the real CPU, and doing what we'll call a context switch of switching what things on the CPU. And, well, if we only have one CPU processor, we have to put the stuff that was on the processor somewhere, so we'll put it in memory. And this is how the operating system is going to provide this abstraction of the thread part of a process, despite, you know, not having a processor for each thread, which is the very common case. That if we look at a typical operating system, it turns out that we all have usually tens or hundreds of threads, and you typically do not have tens or hundreds of cores. And other thing mentioned was devices. And I mentioned that we're going to have these represented with files. So there will be a bunch of files associated with the application, associated with its process, typically. And the operating system will map these to all different types of input-output devices. And it's going to do the translation of this single interface to all these very different interfaces to the different types of products. So those were both implementing sort of our virtual machine interface. Something a bit maybe less clear is when we mentioned this idea of protection, that we want to keep applications from interfering with each other. So one thing you have to think about here is what happens when an application tries to do something that's not supposed to work, like access memory that's not allocated. And in the real hardware, well, that's going to do something, and it's probably, you know, if we let it access the hardware directly, that probably wouldn't be good, but the operating system's going to control what can happen and, for example, translate that invalid memory access into what we might see as a segmentation fault. And sort of generally, you know, our hope is that we can run these multiple applications together in addition to kind of dividing up their resources by having providing them a way of, you know, getting a CPU without really getting a CPU. We're going to prevent them from, you know, even if they're wildly misbehaving, from crashing each other or the OS. That we're going to limit what they can do, you know, and ideally even if they're being malicious. So I mentioned sort of our main way of sharing resources, you know, incidentally here is that, well, you know, accesses to devices go through this file interface, so the operating system gets to decide what to do. Accesses to CPU and memory go through this thread and address space abstraction, which divides up the physical memory and, you know, make sure that we share the CPU time by switching who gets to use it over time. But we need a different hardware mechanism for this protection idea, that we want it to be the case if an application misbehaves and tries to access memory outside the little box we assigned to it, that that doesn't work. And we want that to be the case, you know, even if the application's being malicious. So there are two things that we're going to rely on to implement this protection idea, and needing to have these is going to sort of determine how our operating systems are structured. And this should be 3330 or your other prerequisite for this class review. But I'm going to go over it anyways because people forget, and not sure how well it's covered in the CPE prereq. But one mechanism here is what I'll call do-mode operation, that the processor is going to have a kernel mode and a user mode. And the OS is going to run in kernel mode, well, at least sometimes. It's at least going to control what runs in kernel mode, and some operations are going to require kernel mode. And this is going to include things, you know, that would allow a stray process to break another process, to break the system. So all those operations are going to require kernel mode. The OS is going to make sure processes don't run the application code in kernel mode, so that isn't an issue. And the other thing we're going to need to deal with is that it's going to churn out, we're going to run the application code on the physical processor, that we're, you know, actual application code is running. So this kind of means that, you know, I showed here that the application goes through the OS interface, but really it's this sort of kind of thing where the application sometimes actually talks to the hardware directly. So we need some way that's not going to be okay. So part of this way is this kernel mode idea. The other part of it is going to be that when we access memory, there's going to be address translation. That when the OS is running process A, it's going to set up what memory addresses mean, and it's going to use this to ensure that process A is not accidentally going to interfere with process B's stuff. Also, it can make sure by setting up this mapping that it doesn't interfere with the OS's stuff. So these two mechanisms allow us to provide these abstractions, even though our real picture of, you know, how the application and OS work is that, well, the application sometimes talks directly to the hardware because that's sort of the most efficient way of running its code. But it still conceptually seems like it's running on top of the OS. It's the OS decides what it's allowed to do, because we have this hardware support. And we're going to talk about all about sort of how we implement, use these mechanisms to implement these abstractions. But there are other ways you could write OSs, possibly even more efficient other ways you could write OSs. We're not going to talk about them much in this class because this address translation and dual mode operation are the market winners that every OS you can think of that provides protection, that makes it so a random application can't break the entire OS, use these mechanisms. So that's what we're going to talk about. So questions about dual mode operation and address translation?
Can you explain again just what kernel mode and user mode are?
Okay, so question is what kernel mode and user mode are. So basically any operation that would be dangerous, that would allow an application that, remember, is really, running some code on the hardware to interfere with other applications, we want to disallow. So one example would be is that we have, simple example is, let's say we have these disks here. We don't want to allow applications to do whatever the OS does to talk to these disks directly, because that's going to be a problem, right? That means that the OS won't get to decide how the disk is shared. The application could do something that interferes with a file the other application is using, for example. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's kernel mode.
So kernel mode, operations like that will only be allowed in kernel mode. And there's going to be a whole bunch of things like that which will only allow in kernel mode. Another example is, I mentioned this address translation. We have to set this mapping. Setting this mapping is only going to be allowed in kernel mode. And the way it's going to be implemented on the hardware, basically, is the hardware is going to have like a 1-bit register. And when that register is set to 1, these instructions are going to work. When it's not, those instructions are going to do something else. And we'll talk specifically about what that something else is a bit later. Some follow-ups. And there's a question via chat. Do OSs use both mechanisms? Generally, yes, because, as I mentioned, if we use this address translation, we need to keep the mapping from changing. So that's an example where we kind of need them together, or else it doesn't work. So other questions, follow-ups? So there's a question, what's the difference between running in kernel mode or running programs with root privileges? So root privileges on Unix-like systems is a program that's running as the user root can do essentially anything similar on Windows would be administrator or the system user. And the difference is, when a program is running as root or system or so on, it still has to go through the OS to do things. It still is not going to be allowed, say, direct access to the disk. And what being root or administrator does is it just makes the OS not say no. But it's still going through the OS. It doesn't bypass the OS. It's just a change in how the OS treats its request to use its file and similar abstractions. Other questions, follow-ups? Okay. So we have these mechanisms for, making enforcing that we're sharing the resource with the OS, that we can use kernel mode so the only the OS gets to deal with sensitive things in the hardware, like talking to the I/O devices or changing what memory the currently running thing can access, by making it so only the OS is allowed to run in this special mode called kernel mode, where those changes can happen. But we're actually not quite done, like, enforcing, that the OS gets to, manage these hardware resources. Another thing that we need to have happen is responding to events. That, like, if I'm running a program, and I press a key that's for another program, somehow the OS needs to respond to that, because the OS is implementing the abstraction that program uses to get that key press. And, well, we learned that we're not going to allow normal programs to talk directly to the keyboard anyways. That's probably, not necessarily, but probably going to require that special kernel mode that only the OS has. Another example is if a program uses the CPU for too long, we need to stop it from doing that and let another program run, or else we kind of violated this idea that, one program can't break the whole system for all the programs. And to make this work, we need some way of getting the OS to run to respond to these events. And there's hardware support for this that we cover in 3330, and hopefully you've seen some prior course, but again, I'm not sure about the CPE prereq for this class. Which is known as an exception. You also might have heard some different names. I'm going to try to use the word exception. And this is basically hardware support for running the OS in response to an event. And this is typically integrated heavily with that idea of dual mode operation, that will run the user code in what user mode, that is, equals not kernel mode. And we'll run the OS code in kernel mode, and the exception will be how the processor flips the bit that changes from user to kernel mode, and typically the only way that the hardware will allow this. So the hardware, exception, remember, this is a hardware implemented, basically, special jump to respond to an event. And this will jump to some OS code and also change to kernel mode in the process, because we know that when this happens, the OS is running to handle the events. And it should be allowed to do those extra things like, if a key press happens, talk to the keyboard device. If the program's using the CPU for too long, to change, what memory is available to run a different program. So I mentioned that you might have heard different names for this exception idea. So in 3330, we had this sort of taxonomy of terms that we used. We called exceptions that were triggered by an external event interrupts. We learned that exceptions could be triggered by a program doing something bad. And those were called faults. So a seg fault is a program accesses memory it's not supposed to. That's an event the OS needs to respond to. The processor runs the OS using an exception. Traps, things triggered by explicit action, and we have this category called aborts. I'm not going to be picky about these terms because everyone uses different terms. In particular, XV6 uses different terms. So XV6 calls every type of exception a trap or an interrupt, and doesn't really make distinctions about names. So when I want to be clear about what causes an exception, I'm going to say what, exception, system call, timer, exception, and so on. I'll give the specific cause. And this is unfortunately true of the real world. Like, if you read processor manuals, you'll see, like, the word trap will always mean some sort of an exception, but it will vary exactly how many types of exceptions it encompasses. But besides that terminology note, questions about sort of generally what exceptions are. So one particular type of exception, which is going to come a bunch, is exceptions to access kernel services. So things that require kernel mode, so like allocating memory, reading or writing a file, reading with the keyboard. These are things where a program is running and it wants to use one of those abstractions, like a file or some memory allocation function and so on, that the OS needs to manage. And it needs to run the OS code in kernel mode. How do we do that? Well, I mentioned that this is often the only way to change into kernel mode, so we're going to trigger an exception deliberately. And we're going to call these exceptions, you know, system calls. So we're going to use an instruction that exists to trigger an exception. It's going to work like a normal exception. And the OS handler for this exception is going to say, oh, this wasn't like a key press. This was a program was asking me to do something. I'm going to figure out what that is and handle it. So let's do, So here I have a scenario question, how many exceptions occur and how many system calls? So system calls are application triggered exceptions to get asked the OS to do triggered. And one way of thinking about this is, when does the OS need to do something that's likely to require kernel mode? Give another 15 seconds or so. Okay, so our plurality answer for both is 3 or less. I'll do my counting. So I assume we're starting when we're running process A, and A prompts for input. So this involves showing something on the screen, or, you know, over the network or something. So that's something that, you know, it's a shared resource between multiple programs. We're gonna probably have to go through the OS. So this is probably a system call to do that. And after it shows something on the screen, then it waits for a key press. And most commonly, though, you know, this would be another system call. So, you know, so why does it have to be a system call? Well, you know, one reason is that we can't communicate, you know, check for key presses. We can't communicate with the device directly. And we also want to switch programs. Switch if nothing to do. And, you know, since programs are supposed to be isolated from each other, we're probably going to limit it to the OS running in kernel mode that's going to be able to switch to another program because, you know, we shouldn't be able to change to the other program directly because then we could, like, interfere with the other program stuff. So this is going to be a system call. And typically, you know, we're going to have to do two separate system calls for this, even though conceptually an OS could provide some abstraction where you can prompt and read, wait for input all at once. Most OSs, those are going to be two separate operations with two separate exceptions. But we could imagine making one where we combine that. So we're going to make a system call. The OS is going to say, oh, we're waiting for a key press. Now we need to switch to B. So there's a question. Are we not including the system call from the OS to run B? So B doesn't make a request to run in this timeline. So presumably, because B gets to run, somewhere up here, before this happened, B started. You know, B was running before. And that is where the OS was asked to run B. And the reason it's running B here is that A said, I want to wait for a key press. And as part of handling that, I want to wait for a key press request, the OS said, what am I going to do now? And it looked at what it could do and decided to run B. So the question here, so system calls are from applications to the OS? Yes. So then we know that C gets to run. So somehow we have to switch from A to B. So this is an exception to switch to C. And we don't know why. We don't know, the type. We don't know, was this a timer thing? Did some input come in from the network for C? Or did process B ask to wait for something with a system call? So we don't know whether or not this was a system call or not, but we know that in order to switch from B to C, the OS had to run in kernel mode, so there was an exception to make this happen. Then while C is running, a key press happened, and the OS switched to A immediately. And in order for this to happen, this is another exception triggered by the key press. And this is not a system call, because it was not made by an application, it was made by a key press. So there's a question, switching to B here is neither an exception nor a system call. That is not what I would say. I would say switching to B is part of a system call. And so A made the request with the system call, and it's not until much later that that request is satisfied, but part of making that request was, in addition to the OS noting the request, it switched to B. Is that answer that question? Oh, can I mark the system call in a different color? So I'll put an underline under definitely a system call. And I'll use here, this is may or may not be a system call. Because we don't know why B stopped running from this description. So follow-ups. The question is, the only difference between a system call and an exception whether an application asks for it? Yeah, so a system call is a type of exception. So I do the Venn diagram, we have exceptions and syscall. Other questions? So there's a question of why I don't think this is a syscall. So this, the OS starts, so the syscall is about, whether it's a system call or not, is about why the OS starts running. So the system calls the program that's running, program action of the currently running program. That's when we have a system call. Versus what happened with the interrupt, sorry, with the key press, this is a type of, this is triggered by an external event that's not part of the currently running program. So in the case of this key press, the OS started running because of the key press. What the OS did in response to that external event was satisfy an earlier system call. So it's, you know, finishing up the requested operation from the system call, but there wasn't a system call that made that happen. The system call, you know, that ran the OS happened earlier. So maybe a point of confusion here is that some people will talk about a system call as sort of the entire wait to read and return and back to the A process. I'm just using the term to mean, you know, running the OS for the first time. But if we're counting system calls, the difference doesn't matter, right? We have one system call, two system calls, even though this second request takes until here to get finished. And the question is, does A exiting count for something? Yes. So A exiting is going to be another system call. Because, OS needs to run another program to run something else. A doesn't have the ability to, like, change what program is running. It has to ask the OS for help in that, including for exiting. So I count 1, 2, 3 definitely system calls, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, at least in 5 exceptions, and possibly an extra system call if you think that's why B switched to C. So the question is, if I said A exits, then B runs, would that still be one system call? Yes, because there would be one request from A to stop running, and as part of satisfying that request, the OS ran something else. So the question is, whenever the application shows something on the screen, that's a system call. So generally, we're not going to allow applications to communicate directly with devices. In practice, this might be a little more complicated, but for the most part, typical operating systems that use this kernel mode idea, we never let an application directly talk to a device. So if they want to display something or receive input, the OS has to run as part of that process. Other questions?
Can you give a concrete example of when B switching to C might be a syscall, and another example of when it might be just a regular exception?
So the question is, can I give an example of why this B to C might be a syscall? So one example would be if B was waiting for a key press from, you know, a different terminal. That would be a syscall. And where it might be a different exception, if B just ran for too long and the OS said, you ran for too long, I need to give C a chance, that would be a different type of exception because B didn't request to stop running. Does that make sense?
Yeah. How long is too long?
Well, the OS would have to configure the hardware to and decide that as part of that configuration. And we'll talk about that when we talk about scheduling in a couple weeks. And there's a question, can an OS can trigger an exception while running its own code? Yes, so this is not a, so typically we're going to think about exceptions as being things where an application is running and the exception makes the OS start running, but events that trigger exceptions can still occur while the OS is running and cause, you know, basically a jump within the OS. So for example, if the OS is running and I do a key press, that will interrupt the OS to let the OS handle the key press immediately, even though other OS code might have been running. But for the most part, we're going to think about exceptions as being things that happen when applications are running. And there's a question, wouldn't running B then C count as two exceptions? So the what I'm saying here is what an OS could do is as part while A waits to read, what the OS starts running, it records A is waiting to read and says, what do I do next? And it says, I'm gonna run B, and that whole thing is done with, you know, in response to this whole process is done in response to that wait to read system call. And there's no other exception that needs to happen, and then running C is the second exception to switch from B to C, but the OS just needs to run once to do that. So I mentioned this idea of these deliberately triggered exceptions. So this is what the assembly for this looks like on x86-64 Linux, that we have some kernel code, and this gets run, you know, this gets jumped to by the hardware and gets run in kernel mode. The hardware knows to go there because the OS is part of booting, tells the hardware, hey, this is where you go when this type of exception happens. And the hardware, as part of doing this jump, will go from a mode where privileged operations don't work to ones where they do, where you can do things like I/O and so on. So there's a question. I mentioned that there were types of exceptions that called faults and aborts, and the system calls weren't them. So what's an example of a fault? So we have some examples here of other types of exceptions, like invalid memory access or divide by zero. The hardware needs to say, well, I don't know what to do. It's going to ask the OS by running the OS code with an exception. So this would be these faults would be a type of exception we didn't talk about in that example.
Was the code you showed an application?
So the question is, the code I showed an application? So this is kind of a debatable thing, which we'll get to next. So this is code that would probably be in the standard library on the user side, and on the kernel side, this is in the OS. And something that's persistently loaded called the kernel. And when we talk about OSs, we have this sort of spectrum here that we have the applications, which are typically are not actually written to access system calls directly, but to access standard library functions, like, you know, printf and so on. And those translate into system calls somehow. And depending on who you ask, some people might say, the standard library interface is the OS interface to the applications, and some people might say the system call interface is one. Does that answer your question? Or follow-ups?
I guess I'm just more confused.
So the interface, so on this slide, this code here is typically in a standard library. So if you're writing, like, this is not what your C code that like prints something to the screen is going to compile to. You're going to call a function which has this assembly code.
Okay.
And some people might say that that's part of your application, that like when you compile an app program, it gets put into your application. Some people might say that's part of the OS. It just happens to be loaded with your program. We'll probably make this clearer when we implement system calls and so on later in this semester. So, I'm taking more time than I expected. I'm going to just finish up. So, next time we're going to go into more detail about how system calls work in XV6, which will hopefully make this stuff clearer. So, I mentioned for XV6, you need a Linux environment. It might work on OS X. I'm not going to provide tech support for that. And you need QEMU installed. We provide instructions on how to get one, but you don't have to use ours. If you have a working Linux VM, you can use that. And you'll need to do that. So next time I'll do a little demo of using XV6, and we'll talk about how system calls work in XV6 in sort of gory detail. I think I'm out of time for today. I'll just take questions before I sign off.
A quick question on the Linux stuff. I've been using the Ubuntu piece within Windows. Is that still going to be good enough for this class?
Windows subsystem for Linux, I think last time seemed to be mostly functional. There might be some cases where things are a little weird, but acceptable. Certainly acceptable for the first assignment.
Right, thank you.
So the question, will you be able to use the department node machine setup from 3330? So unfortunately, unless something has changed, the department machines don't have a copy of QEMU installed for you. Questions, will the rough estimate of when the slides will be up on the course website? In a couple hours at most, probably faster. Other questions?